right? So as a simple example, if I send you a video that is more than 2 minutes long, 2 minutes, right?
Okay.
You'll find that people swipe and just move on. They watch the first 10 seconds, watch the first 30 seconds. Don't have the patience, don't have the ability to bear that 2 minutes,
two minutes,
10 minutes to learn something. It has to be quick. It has to be now. It has to be, I only have a few seconds of attention span. And so this is a very big, big issue. It's a very big issue in education. It's a very big issue in different spheres because our efficiency becomes very less.
Yeah.
And our ability to increase knowledge, our ability to gain from the different things out there is very less. And this is why, for example, right now, teenagers and youth don't read books because to read books, you need a very strong attention span.
Yeah.
Unless it's a comic or unless it's got something in it that drives us, whether it's sexual content, whether it's controversies or something that is
something entertaining
basically. But if it's a very important matter written in a very important precise way, teenagers can't do it today.
Yeah,
because they don't have the ability and the cognitive ability to focus and concentrate attention on a particular thing.
All right. I have seen that even adults don't see the videos, which are more than for 2 minutes, just because, as you rightly said, they want it now. They want it just that moment without realizing that they spent hours on it and they can't even bear a video of more than 2 minutes. Well, brother, I'll be discussing with you about more cons after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. I'm with Brother Mikhtar, and we're talking about the cons we can teach our teenagers.
The last point, hopefully, regarding these negative points regarding social media is the exposure to haram. So as Muslims, it is our duty to ensure that we avoid going into haram. And in fact, even more important is that what is very important for us to keep in mind is that we need to stay away to exposure towards haram or stay away very far from the haram. It's like someone who's walking in a mountain, right? When you know the cliff is right there and if you fall, it's going to be a disaster, taking away your life away. You're going to be standing quite far away from the cliff, right, or from the edge. Very few, or rather you would say it's very foolish to stand right at the edge because something happens and you could fall. Best thing is always take a step away, a meter away from the edge. It gives you kind of precaution.
Yeah.
So with the haram, it's the same thing as well. We've been taught in Islam that don't live on the edge, right? Don't live in a place where any moment you could just fall into haram. No, take a step away and avoid exposing yourself to the possibility of committing haram. And we find that social media is a very, it's a platform where haram is very easy to happen. Very, very easy. Let me give you a couple of examples. So first, there is obviously interaction between genders, between mahram and non-mahram, whether it's looking at images that are inappropriate or whether it's sharing and talking to the opposite gender in a way that is more than necessary and therefore becomes haram if it leads to that which is not allowed for us to kind of have a relationship between a boy and a girl.
Okay.
But not just that, also haram content, whether it's images or if it's even words. So we're constantly bombarded with things that, with images, explicit or non-explicit or even content words, sentences that are of nature that is haram for us to read. And so this is something we need to take care of. And we don't have filters on our social media, and we very often fall into this. Now you can say, but I don't look at it, I don't spend time on it. It's true, but if you're constantly seeing the first sight and you know it happens on social media, then we need to be careful of that.
Okay, so just constantly that particular thing coming up for you over there can affect your mind.
That's correct.
Okay, so it's not just the content, the videos, the pictures. It's also the accessibility. It's an easy accessibility to all that haram content that's available over there. And just not only being available, it's also like being shown in a way like this is something that's right, this is something that's needed, this is something that can be used in your leisure time. So yes, there are a lot more things we can talk about that. And actually, the most important thing over here, after knowing so many cons, is how do we deal that? And I would definitely want to know from you about that. How do we deal with all that? After a short break, dear listeners, stay connected to IRIV English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "He who recites the Quran before puberty has indeed been given wisdom in his childhood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we are talking about some of the cons of social media that need to be guided to our teenagers. Brother Miqdad, you were talking about the haram content that's easily accessible, that's available there, that we need to be careful of.
So other things that perhaps we might not have thought about that is also haram. So for example, spreading false rumors. So spreading false rumors is haram. We find that on social media, it's very common.
Yeah.
You hear something and very quickly you forward it. Not having checked, is this correct? Is this wrong? Is this correct? Is it right? Is it dealing with somebody else's private life? Am I backbiting? Or am I being blasphemous regarding certain things that are related to personal lives? Or just false information? Am I somebody who's spreading false information? These things all are haram.
Okay.
But unfortunately, on social media, as we go on and either press a like button or forward it to others, etc., we're part of a movement that involves haram, and we need to be careful of that.
All right. So do you think, like, for example, this also comes in it? For example, sometimes someone sends you a voice note or sends you some kind of picture, and we trust that that particular person is sending all that to you only. But you, when you're kind of close, your close friend is someone else, you're trying to forward all those voice messages, all those pictures to that best friend or so-called best friend without the permission of the other person, other party.
Yes, exposing other people's secrets is something as well that we have. We have that when you have a discussion between two individuals, the content of the discussion should never be spread without the approval of those two individuals.
But sometimes, like, they are especially teens who try to prove themselves that I am right and send screenshots here and there. And sending screenshots is also done without the permission.
Exactly. So it's kind of opening up secrets of other people, which is not correct.
Okay.
Other things that could be haram over here. One of them is making fun of others. So again, something that we do this perhaps often on social media is to make fun of other, mock each other.
Yeah.
And perhaps the other person might not show that they mind, but they might feel really bad. It might have impacts in their lives, in how they think about themselves.
Self-esteem.
Exactly. And so Does this count as a sin to mock somebody, to mock another believer, to make fun of, is something that is haram and we need to be careful of. Another is mocking and making fun of the religion or personalities related to religion. You find that we make fun of Islam, or we make fun of scholars, we make fun of individuals or things related to the religion in the name of joke or in the name of just a laugh. But these things can be haram if it leads to humiliating, degrading, looking down upon the religion or the people involved in, or people, personalities related to religion, or even things related to the religion. So we need to be very careful about these things. Now, okay, there is more as well. So another one, for example, let me mention one last one, is the use of foul language. So swearing, bad language, foul language. So using foul language is something that's not permissible in Islam. And this is something that's not something that's a believer with all the dignity that he has to use such language, basically.
All right. So we talked about so many cons about the social media that we can be, we have to educate our teenagers. Now, what can we do about that? I'll ask you that in another session. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to Islamic Upbringing. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for us, please feel free to contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can listen to this program again on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
You might think twice about throwing out your old trainers after this story. A startup in Tunisia breathes new life into old shoes as artists restore and even customize the footwear. The new business is called Kenenti and is located in the capital, Tunis. Here, the team uses fabrics, laces and leather recovered from various factories for the repair work. The creative artists work on every detail during each project, even the soles of the shoes. The work aims to find solutions to shoe waste and reuse items instead of adding them to the world's landfills. Cherif Zeroui is the co-founder of Kenenti. He says the idea came to him 2 years ago when he discovered the number of shoes thrown away each year in Tunisia.
In France, there were 100 million pairs of shoes thrown away every year. This is a huge figure for us, and for the ecosystem and for the earth. In Tunisia, it's almost the same given the population. There were 3 or 4 million shoes thrown away every year. So we thought of giving added value to these shoes, so we restored them.
Zerbui also says he is happy to create jobs for those willing to participate regardless of the educational degree. Besides shoes, these artists dabble in restoring worn-out handbags, giving them a brand new look. Many of the artists and interns say they are proud to be part of this unique project. They say they feel like a family there. The startup is the first trainer restoration business to be launched in North America.
age does not matter. It's the heart that counts. A Guatemalan female footballer has proved that there is no point one should worry about the age. 57-year-old Alma Salazar has a passion for soccer and takes care of her team's goalpost. Known as Flying Granny, she launches herself and deflects a ball that's looking for the nets. The passion for the sport was born when she was 19 years old. She started training with a men's team where she often found a place as a goalkeeper. Since then, Alma has played for several professional and amateur football clubs. In her room that overlooks a local stadium, Alma keeps the trophies she has won on a table, most of them as the least defeated goalkeeper. Locals praise her as an unbeatable goalkeeper. The evolution of robots has been one of the fascinations of recent technological developments. And now the most cutting-edge achievements in that department were presented to the public during a conference in Beijing. The four-day annual World Robot Conference was held both offline and online. It featured three major events, including forum, expo, and competition. On display were more than 500 sets of robots from 130 companies from China and abroad. The conference gave an idea of how the future of humanity will be impacted by the automations. It shows how they can contribute to different sectors, from the restaurant industry and medicine to elderly care, agriculture, and manufacturing. An inflatable building that explores how people would potentially live on Mars has been unveiled in the British city of Bristol. It's a two-story structure with an area of 570 square feet, powered by solar panels. It's designed to cope with temperatures as low as minus 63 degrees Celsius. Although the Martian house will be displayed above ground, its lower level will be fully buried to maximize protection against the harsh environment on Mars. Inside, the top floor features a hydroponic living room filled with decorative plants that feed into a circular wastewater system. A team of experts helped develop the design, taking into consideration the complexity of transporting materials to the red planet and what is already there.
So in the gold inflatable structure which you see above you, that's the main living space of the Martian house. It's gold to reflect dangerous solar rays and cosmic radiation, and it's inflatable because it would be filled with a special concrete made of the dust and water that you find on Mars, again, to protect you from those dangerous solar and cosmic rays.
The Martian house was envisioned by local artists 7 years ago. The artists also brought together space scientists, architects, engineers, designers, and even school children. The space age dwelling explores what a house on Mars could be like and is meant to for research and experiments about the future. The major objective of the project, however, is to provoke questions about living more sustainably with the resources at hand here on Earth.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Japanese plastic food artisans are showcasing their mouth-watering artificial creations at an exhibition in Japan's capital city, Tokyo. From the Leaning Tower of Pizza to fish slicing and cooking, or even the quirky stacked pancakes, you can find almost everything at the exhibit. Other sculptures, including a deep-fried shrimp with four-breaded legs scaling a mountain of shredded cabbage like a tiger. Another creation on display is a Tetris game made of chicken. Plastic food artists get really excited for the exhibition each year as they are given a chance to practice their own spin on creativity, bringing food to life with curious characters.
So normally we have to follow orders from clients. We take their views on board when we're making items. Normally that's our work. But for the competition, you can use your imagination. How it finally ends up is totally up to you. I like that aspect of it.
There are some 60 sculptors on display. Some are silly, but others highlight the artist's skills. The models were made with the same careful detail as the rock-solid noodle soups and crispy-looking plastic snacks on display outside Japanese restaurants. There is a lucrative business for them in Japan.
Forest management plays a key role in mitigating climate change. Like many world countries, China has accelerated environmental and social structural changes in urban spaces to deal with this pertinent issue. The Donggu Forest Park is one such project that has provided city dwellers enough space to breathe. It comes into being from what local people usually called rotten woods. The park on the northern bank of the Xialinge River covers an area of nearly 120 hectares. Nobody would come there before, as the place was full of flies and mosquitoes. But now, with the environment improved and water cleaned in the river, the place has turned into a wonderland, attracting locals and even foreign tourists.
Now the sky is blue, the water clean and the air fresh, with green greeting you wherever you go. The elderly play Tai Chi or do bodybuilding exercises here. Young people play football, basketball and table tennis.
Over the past 20 years, a large number of cities in China have undergone a brief but rapid urban expansion. Most of these cities are now facing social problems such as an aging population and a high prevalence of chronic diseases. A comprehensive environmental improvement program in the area was initiated in 2014 in order to create space for those who want to take a break from their everyday works.
Whilst not being as painful as a broken limb, animals like humans suffer from chronic and acute pain from gum infections, broken teeth, and bacterial spread through the circulation. A 16-year-old elephant in Pakistan is one such case. Madhubala, suffering for years from a dental infection caused by a broken tusk, has finally got relief thanks to vets, dentists. Named after a legendary Indian actress, Madhubala's eyes were taped shut, her legs tied to support her during sedation and subsequent treatment at a Karachi zoo. The vets had to use drills and other heavy surgical tools to extract the infected tusk. She is one of four African elephants being treated in Karachi by an eight-member team from Global Animal Welfare Group, Four Paws. A Pakistani court last year asked Four Paws to assess the health of the animals after local animal rights activists raised concerns about their well-being. England's Paradise Wildlife Park welcomes its new guest, an endangered red panda cub. The mother, Tilly, gave birth to the cub just 1 month after she lost her breeding partner, Nampang. Experts say Tilly had been under a breeding project for 4 years. The cub has been named Little Red, and his birth is being celebrated as a, quote, symbol of hope. Red pandas are classed as an endangered species and are on the red list of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The bushy-tailed bamboo munchers dwell in high-altitude Asian forests, and their population is now fewer than 2,500. Lightning strikes are very powerful and misunderstood force of nature that we all often see being used in films. A spectacular lightning strike has illuminated the sky over the Scottish town of Dundee. A video from an eyewitness that captured the hypnotic scene has been shared on several social media platforms. The lightning in the clip can be seen sending several bolts in opposite directions. Below, a church spire is silhouetted against the lightning flashes. But lightning is not always spectacular, as sometimes it causes fire to tower and high rises. Last month, a wind turbine caught fire after being struck by a lightning bolt in North Texas, United States. Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals.
Stunning scenes in Spain as the last supermoon of the year illuminates the night sky amid fireworks and fairs marking the start of festivities for a public holiday. In Malaga, fireworks left the sky a mix of colors against the bright moon. There was also a spectacle of drones that lightened the sturgeon moon. Locals in the Canary Islands also celebrated the three-day holiday by lighting up a Ferris wheel as the full moon beamed beautifully in the sky. If the moon is within 10% of its closest distance to Earth at the moment of full moon, it is called a supermoon. The supermoon has various hues and appears bigger and brighter than when the moon is at its farthest point from Earth.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio is a guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Hujjatul Islam Academy. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Karimi, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
For today's question, we want to talk about the role that the Persians had in helping Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and whether the Persians, especially after the tragedy of Karbala, who were part of the revenge group of Mukhtar al-Saghafi, had the chance to help Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the story of Karbala or not. Before anything, I would like to say that, the great Persia at that time and Iraq were one land, and geographically speaking, we did not have geographical borders like we have today. So the Persians, or the Mawalis as they call it, they were not Arab originally, but because they were living in the, we can say, under the Arab governorship and rulership, somehow they attached themselves to a famous Arab tribe. That's why they were called Mawalis. Let's get to this question, Shaykh. Did the Persians did not find a chance to help Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? They were not aware of this story because the leader of the tribes were Arab and they were not sensitive about the case? Or what was the story?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, there is a difference when it comes to the tragedy of Karbala and the army of Mukhtar.
Yes.
Mukhtar, officially speaking, he began a war against those oppressive people who killed Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So people came to know that there is a kind of uprising by Mukhtar. So many people had the chance to join his army, including, as you rightly mentioned, Mawadi or the non-Arabs,
yes,
which at that time referred to many Iranians as well. So we have many Persians who had the chance to join the army of Mukhtar at that time. But when it comes to the tragedy of Karbala, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, when he's going out of the city of Medina, he's not going to a war, practically speaking.
Yes.
So he's not announcing that, oh, people, please come and help me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to a war with Yazid. I'm preparing an army. So let all the people who want to help me, help me.
Okay.
And then Imam goes to Mecca, and then he's invited by the people of Kufa. So that is why, there is a difference between,
yes,
the two. So the Imam doesn't ask for all the people to join him.
Yes.
And that is why he's only accompanied by his family members and some of his companions and some of the people who, gradually speaking, joined the caravan of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the way from
Medina to Karbala.
From Mecca to Karbala,
yes,
or Kufa.
Okay.
So that is why we shouldn't think that, mm-hmm, all the people who wanted to join could join the army, mm-hmm, of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because it was not mentioned officially that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is going to a war.
Yes.
So this is one point.
Okay.
The second point is that, according to some reports, there were some Mawalis present in the tragedy of Karbala as well.
Yes.
They were not many, of course. We are talking about less than 100 people with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And that is why we cannot claim that so many Persians joined the Imam.
Yes.
But according to some historical reports, some Mawali were present in this tragedy as well. And
yes,
Mawali is referring to non-Arab people, including the Persians at that time.
Can we name, for example, Salim ibn Umar? Salim?
He's called Aslam ibn Amr,
yes,
according to some historical reports.
Yes.
And of course, I'm just quoting some of the scholars,
yes,
who mentioned some names, and they believe that they were among the Mawali,
mm-hmm,
and they were present in the tragedy of Karbala.
Okay.
So right. Aslam ibn Amr is one of them, and he was with the caravan Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Even his Rajas, his poem before, fighting the enemies, is mentioned in the sources.
Okay.
And finally, he is martyred in the tragedy of,
yes,
Karbala. The next name is Rafi ibn Abdullah.
Yes.
His name is mentioned mainly by the books written after the book Bahar al-Anwar by Allama Majlisi and in some other sources. I'm not claiming that for sure all these people,
yes,
were present. There are,
yes,
some debates among the historians, but the,
okay,
point is that these names, as Mawali, as non-Arab people, are mentioned in the sources,
yes,
as the people who were present. So we shouldn't think that
yes,
no Persian was present in the tragedy of Karbala.
But originally speaking, it is documented that Persians had the love for Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah.
From the time of Prophet Muhammad Salman al-Farsi, who was also a truthful companion of Imam Ali alayhi salam, this is really important. and all the following generation of the Persians who were beside Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and the other infallible Imam. This love was present on
but
that
we time. Shouldn't think that the Persians the majority of the Persians had this love from day one. No, gradually speaking, in Persia, the love for the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam
was established. Flip side is, what if I am Shia? If we are weeping for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, we're good and lover of Ahlul Bayt. That's enough. We know it's necessary for salvation, but is it enough or not? This is the question. One of the companions of the Imam goes to him and says to him, there are some who consider the harams not to be haram. And they say that the religion equals ma'rifah, just to know. Know that this is your imam and so on, that's enough for you. So do whatever you like. After you know the imam, do whatever you like. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. They have misinterpreted. They have done a false ta'wil of what has been said. When I said, have ma'rifa of the imam, know the imam, acknowledge the imam and the wilayah of the imam, do whatever you like, you're good to go. What I meant was, do whatever you like of ta'ah and obedience of Allah and ibadah. Because if you do, since you have the condition for the acceptance, it will be accepted from you. This is what I meant. Because Allah doesn't accept from someone who does something without the ma'rifah of us Ahlul Bayt. In other words, it's necessary, but is it enough or not? No, it's not enough. And then he goes on to say, if someone does all the good deeds in the world and fasts the whole life and stays awake all the nights and prays and so on and so forth, but doesn't know his Prophet who brought these fara'id, who brought these rulings, these wajibat and muharramat, he brought them, and doesn't know his imam of his time, that Allah has made it wajib on you to follow, then his amal will not be accepted. This is what I meant.
The next name in this list is Zahir ibn Amr al-Kindi. The next one is called Firuzan. According to some sources, he's one of the Iranians, one of the Persian companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who was martyred on the land of Karbala. The next is Nasr ibn Abi Nazar. So the second point is that this is not true to claim that no Persian person was present in the tragedy of Karbala.
Even according to some resources, the wife of Imam al-Hussein was originally Persian, isn't it?
Those people who believe in that historical
background,
story about Shah Banu,
yes,
they believe that she was an Iranian person.
Yes. But all in all, after the tragedy of Karbala took place, the Persians were present at least in Mukhtar al-Saqafi, isn't it?
A group army
and so many famous commanders of his army were Persians. Yeah. They were really helpful.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Okay.
I mean, the army of Mukhtar included some people from Persia. And one of the reasons is that, let me refer to another point, and the point is that at that time, at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the Mawali are not taken seriously by the people, and by the rulers. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam does not, as I mentioned, does not announce and ask people before going out of the city of Medina or Mecca for people to come and join him. But when it comes to the time of Mukhtar, Mukhtar comes and respects to Mawadi as well. So at that time, it was unfortunately common among the Umayyad caliphs to take the Mawali as the second citizen or the third citizen.
Yes.
But this is not true about Mukhtar.
Mm-hmm.
Mukhtar pays attention to all the people who want to join his army and to take revenge from the enemies of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes.
And maybe this is one of the few occasions in which the Mawali come to know that they can also play a role.
Mm-hmm.
And they are taken seriously by a person like Mukhtar. And that is why we have many people, and one of them are among the commanders of the army of Mukhtar. So, as I mentioned, we need to pay attention to all these points.
Yes.
As I mentioned, first of all, according to some, at the end of the day, the companions of the Imam Hussein alayhi salam were about 70 people.
Yes.
So we cannot imagine that so many Persians could have been present in the tragedy of Karbala. No, they were only few people. And okay. The Imam did not announce, officially speaking, and asking for help for all his companions coming from different corners of the world,
okay.
of the world, including the great Persia of that time. No, it didn't happen.
No.
As I mentioned, the companions of the Imam joined him, some of them from Medina, some from Mecca, and some on the way. So the Imam is not officially announcing that I'm going to a war. And also I said and referred to the fact that having said that, some historical sources talk about few Persians who were present in that tragedy of Karbala. So if these stories are true, the conclusion is that this is a wrong assumption to think that no Persian was present at that time. No, according to some historical reports, there were few people, and we refer to some of the names.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding the presence of the Persians among the army of Mukhtar al-Saqafi, who took revenge for Imam al-Hussein's martyrdom from the great Afghanzi oppressors to the rights of Imam al-Hussein and the Ahlul Bayt. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amal Allah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محب لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
I do hope that these gatherings, these meetings or congregation for lamenting and reciting elegies in remembrance of the master of the oppressed, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, be arranged more often on a wider scale from the grand orators and deliverers of sermons to the man who just stands by the pulpit and recites a few lines of elegy. All have a share in the success of these morning sessions. They all have a natural influence on proceedings, though some may not be aware of it. We have reached a station at which our nation exploded all at once instead of revolution. Such an explosion has been matchless.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. We seek refuge from Satan the accursed, and in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we start another episode of the program, The Spring of Truth. Welcome to this program in which we try to reflect and contemplate and shed some light and paraphrase some of the sayings and valuable words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, who is the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Now, he says, that which places our planet on the verge of collapse is moral perversion. Moral perversion. Well, true. Islam offers a set of rules and laws to regulate people's lives and bring order to the lives of mankind. That which we call it the Sharia. But we shouldn't forget the fact that ethics and akhlaq play a key role in life.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi salli ala
I have actually fallen in love with this beautiful hadith of the Prophet where he says, "Inni bu'ithu li'utammima makarim al-akhlaq." This is so fabulous, so beautiful, which means I've been appointed as a prophet to perfect moral ethics. Moral ethics. That is why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala appointed Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam to come as our teacher, as our father, to help us perfect our moral ethics. If you empty your life of morality, you have taken away the spirit of life. You know, within the family, within our colleagues, our neighbors, friends, citizens of a society, what smoothes the atmosphere and what builds a feeling of trust, love, and care is ethics. So let us all practice becoming better people ethically. And thank you very much for being with us and listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
لا إله إلا
American immigrant family.
Part 1.
We've been here to the United States a lot. We used to come every year for a vacation, and we really liked the U.S. We saw it's a great country.
This is a huge country. This is a beautiful country. This country is country for everybody.
That's why we decided we wanted to continue our life and move here to the U.S. and have a future here in the U.S.
Samir Megahed, an engineer, moved from Egypt with his wife and four children to a quiet cul-de-sac in Tampa, Florida in 1998. Samir found work and his eldest sons followed in his footsteps pursuing engineering degrees. In 2009, the family celebrated becoming American citizens. But their son Yusuf was missing.
A friend told us, how is Yusuf? We told him he's fine. He went to a beach trip with some of his friends. He told us, did you see CNN? And we were amazed that he was telling us to check Yusuf on CNN.
In August 2007, Yusuf Megahed was on a road trip with his college friend Mohammed, visiting beaches in the south. They were pulled over for driving 60 in a 45-mile-an-hour zone in the small South Carolina town of Goose Creek. But when Mohammed told the officers he had homemade fireworks in the car, they were both arrested and charged with transporting explosives across state lines.
We saw this as a mistake that hopefully will be solved by the next day. But then the story didn't end the next day, and it continued now for almost 2 years. He was arrested with fireworks. If any white kid or anyone who's not a Middle Eastern would be stopped by a police officer and he would have fireworks, they would consider this to be something ordinary, and they are going to the beach and they are having some fun. But for a Middle Eastern, even this legal stuff that is enjoyed or allowed for any person living here in the U.S., it's considered to be banned or illegal for him. So I think it was almost like a wake-up call that like Arabs and Middle Easterns and people from an Islamic background, they don't enjoy the same rights or same freedoms offered to other people here in the U.S.
Although no formal charges of terrorism were ever filed, Yusuf was held for 10 months in solitary confinement. It was over a year and a half before his trial began.
In the past 2 years, our life is changed completely. It looks like a nightmare. You live under pressure from the biggest government all over the world. If the biggest government all over the world targeting your son, and you know your son is innocent, you're thinking it's crazy. Because Yusuf has a Middle East face and he's carrying Quran, his suspicion on him.
Justify their hatred.
Stop all Muslim immigration. Is that the best way to protect America and our economy from new terror attacks?
The fact of the matter is, these guys want to kill us. We have to fight them. And we have to support law enforcement
guys,
who want to fight
these
them.
Guys.
You know, Quentin goes all over the map here. We got to get these guys before they
and
kill
that's
innocent
gotta be
people.
The
if you are an 18 to 28-year-old Muslim man, then you should be strip searched.
So there's always confusion about Islam. Is it a religion of violence or peace?
Islam is a violent, I was going to say religion, but it's not a religion. It's a political system. It's a violent political system bent on the overthrow of the governments of the world and world domination.
In the years since the September 11th attacks, advocacy groups claim that the United States has witnessed an anti-Muslim and anti-Arab backlash. Issam Zayem is president of the Cleveland office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. Nationally, CARE has tracked a 5-fold surge in civil rights complaints by Muslim Americans since 2001.
the atmosphere and the environment and the media had created a very false perception about Islam and Muslims, especially American Muslims. So we were all lumped in the categories of the fifth column or the terrorists. If you look into the major cities in the country, you will find that there has been major cases all over the country.
The Department of Justice is waging a deliberate campaign of arrest and detention to protect American lives. We're removing suspected terrorists who violate the law from our streets to prevent further terrorist attack. We believe we have Al-Qaeda membership in custody, and we will use every constitutional tool to keep suspected terrorists locked up.
The U.S. Department of Justice refuses to release a tally of how many people it has detained since the beginning of its so-called war on terror. From 2001 to 2003 alone, however, at least 27,000 Arabs and Muslims inside the United States were detained and interrogated by the FBI, and 7,000 arrested. 145,000 Arab and Muslim immigrants were questioned as part of a special registration program, and of those, nearly 14,000 had deportation proceedings started against them. Sami Hammoudi was a PhD student in applied anthropology and an instructor at the University of South Florida, the same university Yusuf Megahed attended as an engineering student. He and his family had moved to Tampa from Palestine in 1992, so Sami could pursue his studies. In 2003, he was arrested as a co-conspirator in the Sami Al-Aryan case and charged with terrorism.
Today, the United States Department of Justice is announcing the indictment of Sami Al-Aryan and seven co-conspirators. All of the defendants, if convicted, face the potential of life sentences. Al-Aryan's U.S. associates and Palestinian Islamic Jihad members arrested today include Sami Hammoudi.
At the very beginning of the case, I thought that there are misunderstandings.
They came around 4 a.m., 4 in the morning. They just came knocking on the door very strongly, and my wife woke up and we opened the door. Then they came to me and said, "You are under arrest for charges of terrorism, for supporting terrorism."
Rabia Haddad came to the U.S. to study in 1980, fleeing the violent civil war in Lebanon. After a career with various aid organizations, in 1992, Haddad founded the Global Relief Foundation, or GRF. It became the second largest Islamic charity in the United States, providing aid to 680,000 people worldwide. In 2001, he was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan with his wife and four young children. He worked as the chairman of GRF and volunteered as an imam at the local mosque. 3 months after 9/11, the government designated his charity a terrorist entity.
They raided our offices December 14th. It was a Friday. And I remember coming home after the Friday prayer. I felt that I was being followed coming back from the mosque. But I didn't think, you know, I thought, well, if they're raiding our offices in Chicago, it's, I think, normal to put me under surveillance or, you know, whatever. But then maybe an hour after that, they knocked at my door and arrested me. And things went downhill from there.
The theory that gave, let's say, legitimacy to all, in their thought, to all of these actions was Muslims and Arabs are either terrorists or potential terrorists. So we have to do things to control these communities. And this is what they did. And this is what they are still doing. Nothing changed.
Back in Tampa, Yusuf's court-appointed lawyer, Adam Allen, worried that the prevailing political and media climate would make his case nearly impossible to win.
Initially, obviously, when you are appointed to represent somebody from the Middle East originally, who is charged with the transportation of explosive materials, as a defense lawyer, you have some great concerns about the ability to